I am strong. I have decided to move out of my comfort zone. I have the power to do whatever I set my heart to. Even if that means asking for help from another, I am willing to keep getting back up each time I fail and fall. I cannot and will not be broken.
To start things off, there's a line in the book that says, the real secret to becoming strong is simply being who and what you are. Now, why do you think, Ned, that this is an important part of becoming strong?
Well, I think it comes from the fact that, for me, it took a lot of courage to initially step out and be who I am. My nature is that I'm a gentle, caring person, but my behavior didn't support that because I, for a long time, my imposed gender roles were dictating how I should behave. It reminds me of a time when I was working in the factory, and this is a hilarious story.
Okay.
It's one that I'm not embarrassed to tell because, you know, I had a bit of a rough past at times. So when I first started waking up and discovering who I am and looking into spirituality, I decided I was going to learn how to do Reiki. So Reiki is a hands-on healing technique where you draw energy into you and you pass it on to the person. So, and this was a far stretch for me because my dad's just kind of a typical guy, and you know, we cut wood when we were younger and build things and drank beer.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
When I first started coming out to and doing Reiki and then telling people I was doing Reiki, I felt really insecure about it. I felt pretty like, okay, this is not, and at the time it wasn't even a practice that was mainstream. So I decided that I was going to put a Reiki flyer up at the factory I worked in.
Okay.
Now, to frame this properly, you have to realize when I did this, it was in my early 20s. So this is like 20 years ago when Reiki was hardly known by anybody, and it was just such an out there concept that, you know, it was for to put it up in a factory full of men who, you know, had no desire to get a Reiki session or a healing per se from another dude. Like it's just, I look back at it now and I think there's no way I was going to pull any clients out of that flyer going up in the factory.
Yeah. Right.
So I put this poster up and I'm feeling pretty insecure about the whole thing. And the one day I was walking towards the front of the, up to the lunchroom, and I saw this guy pointing at the flyer laughing. And so right away, because I was embarrassed, I went right to anger, because back then, you know, it was hard for me to express any other emotion than anger. Mm-hmm. So because I felt embarrassed, I got angry, and I went up to the guy and I grabbed him right by the throat and I threw him against the wall. And I said to him, I said, do you think that's funny? And well, because my hand was gripping his throat, his answer was no. And then I suddenly it dawned on me, hold on, I'm advertising healing.
That's why I'm laughing.
So, and this is supposed to be something that makes you feel good and is peaceful. Now I'm choking a person. So I don't know what the next step should or could have been in that scenario. Maybe I could have done some Reiki on him. I don't know.
Reiki on his throat.
On his throat for squeezing his throat. But it's just, it illustrates for me, like it took a lot of courage to just discover who I am. But that discovery is one of the most worthwhile pursuits that we go on. When you discover who you are, you also get to discover your purpose that lies within. And living a purposeful life empowers us so greatly. And it's one of the things that makes us strong is by living our purpose. And that's the byproduct of being who we are. Because there's a lot of things that we do. We just do it because everybody else is doing it.
Mm-hmm.
You know,
getting back to the lemmings room of the mind.
That's right. Exactly.
That's very interesting. And so when you're talking about the Reiki poster and at that point in your life, and also society is not on board with it yet or hardly aware of it, that also is going to make you feel that much more uncomfortable because you know that it's not a mainstream thing yet. So here's the thing, though, like if that is in fact the first step into walking into your purpose, and as we are speaking now and everything that you've done since then, it was clearly a step in the right direction of some kind. It was at least you're treading in the direction you ought to. If you're feeling really vulnerable and self-conscious about that, and you don't even go any further into it because your mind is indicating or raising up signals saying, hey, man, this doesn't feel quite right. There's something very uncomfortable to this. Perhaps this isn't for you. Maybe you're a fraud because you're stepping into something like this that you don't feel you represent. I mean, even, I know we're laughing about it, but by you strangling someone because they responded, in a way that really targeted your vulnerability in the first place, that even could be a signal saying, I don't know if I'm the right person to even be doing this because I clearly can't manage my emotions and my behaviors when someone targets my vulnerabilities like that. So how do you keep treading even though you are slightly uncomfortable? How can you know when your mind is screaming at you, no, this is not comfortable for me. This is not where you need to be right now.
So it's how do we learn how to become strong, really? It's with practice. And there has to be a willingness to push yourself outside of your comfort zone. So when I put that poster up, that was like probably about six steps out of my comfort zone. You know, it'd be like back then I was working in a man's world, and it was if you weren't a man's man, you were a pussy, or you're a wimp, you're a fairy, you're all those derogatory terms that, you know, that just aren't true. So I had to be willing to push myself outside of my comfort zone. There was something in me that knew that doing Reiki back then was purposeful for me. It was pointing me in the right direction.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I think one of the things that we need to do in addition to pushing ourselves out of our comfort zone, and your question alluded to this, we need to kick out the feeble voice in our head. You know, being strong is sometimes a decision that we make, and it's a decision that we keep making. And it's we continuously make the decision to do what it is that we need to do, that we know that we need to do. Mm-hmm. So I knew I had to do something, and so I had to make that decision, and I had to keep making that decision until I actually followed through with it. Because that voice in your mind will say you can't, you shouldn't, you better not. It'll come up with 30 different reasons why you shouldn't be purposeful in your life. But that's just your ego talking.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because something you were saying, like when you're working in the factory and if you're not a man's man, you're a pussy and a wimp, and or the you shouldn't, you can't, what are you doing? Those essentially are all just, you're putting labels on yourself.
When we succumb to that too, we just give up before we actually try. And the thing about giving up is that it becomes a reflex that we lean into more often. If we get in the habit of giving up and just quitting,
mm-hmm.
then it becomes a reflex that we just fall into more readily. And so you have to be not only willing to move out of your comfort zone, kick out the feeble voice in your mind, you have to make the decision and not give up before you try. You also have to be willing to fail. That's another point that I have learned in my life. Becoming strong, I have to be willing to lose a few things, mm-hmm. and to not be right, to for things not to work out, you know, to not be supported. Even becoming a tattoo artist, when I worked in the factory back then, everybody was telling me, oh, you don't want to do that. Like, you've got a great job here working in the factory.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but I had to be strong enough in me to say, no, I want to do that. And people would say, well, what about the benefits? And when I look back at that now, that factory I used to work in is closed.
Right.
Nobody has any benefits out of that factory.
Yeah, sure.
And they're all working in different places.
Yeah, yeah. People find security in odd things, though. Mm-hmm. Like, what is security? I mean, in your position as a tattoo artist, I would say that your level of devotion to your art is going to guarantee you more fruit for longer periods of time. I mean, if you were sort of half-stepping with that, and maybe it's something you do, but you're not fully committed to it, and you're not, maybe you're not even a great artist. You're just doing it because you think you want to be that. I mean, that in and of itself, the fact that you are really good at it, but you, when people spend time with you, like Amanda, my wife, has had work done by you, and not only does it look great, but she also talked about how the experience of interacting with you was nice. And so, like, you provide this other level of service with what you do because of the person that you are. And so, like, your personality bleeds through your work as well in that sense when you're interacting with your clients. So, like, what would you say is the difference between dedication and devotion? Because I would say that you're quite devoted to the things that you do yourself.
There's a huge difference there with, and I explain this in my book with a chart, and then I explain the chart bit. The chart shows how when we start out with doing something, we want to achieve a goal or do something in our lives. We usually will get dedicated. It will introduce, say, I'm dedicated to this task at hand. Mm-hmm. The problem with dedication is that it may get you to the goal if you remain dedicated. But in our dedication, it doesn't actually make us really committed to the idea. So and you think of it this way. Say you're an employer and you had 10 dedicated employees. Mm-hmm. It'd be a good business with having that many dedicated employees. Mm-hmm. Now, can you imagine how differently that would be as if you had 10 devoted employees? Now, so I'm going to define devotion. Devotion is everything that dedication has, but with the inclusion of love. So it's you're dedicated with a sense of love towards what you're doing. Mm-hmm. Now, can you imagine if you had 10 employees and all of those employees loved what they did? They loved coming to work. And would that not be one of the most best playgrounds to work in? It would certainly provide a much more pleasant day. I would think your days would go very quickly. Mm-hmm. And what that does, when you're devoted to something, and you're pouring in love to it, it actually puts you 10 miles past any finish line or quitting point. Mm-hmm. Dedication may get you to the finish line, or it may get you to the point where you can you end up giving up. But devotion puts you into what your potential is. Because my mind would always try to achieve a goal. And so, but in my life now, any goal that comes to me that I want to create, the goal is the minimum I think I can achieve. Mm-hmm. Where in the past, when I just be dedicated, it would be the maximum that I could achieve would be the goal. Mm-hmm. So by learning how to become devoted to my work or anything that I pour myself into, I've realized that my potential lies in my devotion. You know, and we can renew our devotion, mm-hmm. at any point, we can just totally submerge ourselves into what we're doing and just bring a sense of love and passion into our work.
Right. Because something that I've seen and heard being talked about is company culture, where companies, small companies, are going the extra mile to make sure that their employees are pleasant and that they really enjoy coming to work. And so generally, like, the CEO of a company is really mindful of different things that they can do for their business and their employees to make their work life more pleasurable. But this, again, like, the common thread with this book and this conversation is that you should be able to be self-reliant to provide yourself with those things. That would suggest what I just said is that you're looking to someone else to provide that for you. But could it be a combination of the two? Like, if your work is a great place to be and you yourself love the line of work, I guess that would be an absolute ultimate experience, then that's the best thing you can hope for.
Well, devotion is, being devoted is coming from a place of love within you and pouring that into what you do. I talked about that in my book. I remember going out west, and one of the experiences I've had in my life was I went out and I had this idea that I was going to write a book about tattooing.
Mm.
And it was in the realm of possible, because that's what I do for a living. I'm a tattoo artist, but it wasn't something that my mind readily wanted to do. I wanted to write a book called Be Love, a book about awakening. So, and then that was heavily on my mind even back 10 years ago, before, you know, this book ever came into fruition. So, but I had this intuition that I was going to write this book about the history of tattooing. And so I decided to go out and interview all these different tattooists. Mm-hmm. And in my book, I tell a story about going out to the Dutchman tattoo and tattooing at his shop. One thing that I noticed is that the Dutchman, John the Dutchman, he was very devoted to everything he did.
Mm-hmm.
So if he was tattooing his client, he was 100% there, devoted to it. And you could almost feel it coming out of him. And then I would sit and watch him tattoo while I was there as much as I could. And if I asked him a question, he would just stop what he's doing, direct his focus at me, and give me 100% of an answer.
Mm-hmm.
So he became devoted to me. And then he would switch back to his tattoo, and he's devoted to that. But I could really, really see how he wouldn't split his attention up into multiple things. When he was devoted to something, he put all of himself into that. And you could almost feel a sense of love.
So what's your thoughts then on multitasking?
Well, it's a skill that I think people, our employers, look for in its ability to, but I don't think it's the best way to really pour yourself into something. I think multitasking should be done just like what I was explaining. You do one thing and then you do the next thing. And if you have to go back to the first thing, like, I think we really should be put all of our attention to one thing at a time. Mm-hmm. We can't do two things at one time properly. You know, why put half of your effort into one thing and half into another task? Life's not that busy. Like, we, you know, there's enough time in the day. And if there's not, then there's always tomorrow. There's no emergency to life. You know, what doesn't happen will happen later, or maybe it's not meant to happen.
Yeah, there is a sense of urgency to things. Everybody is in sort of a race to get to the finish line with a lot of stuff, especially when it's a long, long trek and it takes a long time to get wherever it is that you're going to. People are in a very big rush to get there. But I want to go back to the comfort zones and experiencing vulnerability and how that equals growth. Because we talked about that as you put up your Reiki posters, for example. You felt pretty uncomfortable about that. And the conflict ensued. But in any case, how do we find the strength to walk through our vulnerabilities?
Okay, if you look at vulnerability, it comes from your ego. Your soul isn't vulnerable. Mm-hmm. So vulnerability, and where the ego in us is simply a voice in your head, or it manifests through a feeling in your body. But, you know, much like a thought, we can let it go. Much like a feeling, we can let those go. Mm-hmm. We tend to put so much stake in what we think and what we feel that when it's a self-defeating thought, like a vulnerability, that we put it at a higher level of importance, and it's not. It's really not. And to understand that your vulnerabilities is just your ego feeling insufficient. So walking through your vulnerabilities sort of sets your ego down, and it says, you know what? It's okay. I'm not going to be a master at anything until I put some time in.
Mm-hmm.
Or maybe I'll never be a master of the things that I want to try to master in this life. But when we change our relationship to the voices in our head, then everything changes. Another way to look at vulnerability is just fear taking ownership of the body. And we reclaim our power by overriding our fears. You know, mm-hmm. another funny story that comes to mind is years ago when I first started tattooing, it was like my first year into tattooing, I got it in my head. There was this tattoo convention happening in Guelph. And I thought, I want to go to this.
Okay.
Now, when I look back at that time in my tattooing, I knew nothing about what I was doing. I was pretty much self-taught at that point.
Okay.
I had a little bit of pointers from a few people. So I decided I'm going to go tattoo at this convention. So I call up this tattooist in Guelph. His name's Paul Vickery. And he was putting on the Royal Canadian Tattoo Expo. And I get him on the phone. I said, yeah, I want to come and tattoo at your show. He says, what's your shop name? And I said, back then it was Ned's Needles.
Oh, really?
Yeah. It wasn't Endless Boundaries. For the first year and a bit, my business was named Ned's Needles. It's sort of a precarious name to...
Watch for your step.
So... Paul says to me, he says, Ned's Needles, I never heard of you. Where are you from? You got a shop? And I says, well, no, I'm tattooing in my home. Well, so you're a scratcher, he says. Scratcher. Well, I don't know. Like a scratcher, for those of you who may not understand the term, it's someone who has no training like me. Like I didn't have any training back then and just trying to pick it up on their own.
Okay.
And their tattoos end up look like somebody scratched the skin. And they're terrible.
Gotcha.
So I said, no, I'm not a scratcher. And I said, he says, well, look, this show is for professionals. And I said, well, how about I come up and show you my work? And then you decide whether you want me to come tattoo at your show. He says, yeah, okay. Yeah, whatever. Come on. Come this day at this time. So I, with my portfolio in tow, I take myself up to Guelph and I get to his shop. And I'm pretty nervous. When I get to the door of his shop, Paul and his wife were having this massive screaming match at each other. And I'm like, oh, crap. This is a bad timing. So I kind of pull the door open a little bit, and they both kind of stop and look at me. And I said, yeah, I come here to show you some of my work for the convention. I'm Ned. And... Paul right away says, all right, go sit down over there. And then his wife was extremely mad because I was interrupting this massive fight they're having. So Paul comes over and he's violently flipping through my portfolio. And I'm thinking, there's no way I'm not getting into this show. And then all of a sudden he stops and turns it back to the beginning and starts going back through it slowly. And I'm like, oh, okay. So then... he looks at me, he sets the portfolio down, and he looks at me and he says, this show is for people just like you. I want you to come tattoo at my show. And I'm like, okay, that's not what I was expecting. I was going up there to get rejected. So I'm like, okay. So he gives me a package to fill out, and then I had to mail back the monies to pay for the booth. So I get driving home, and I realize the gravity of what the choices, what I was doing, and realize that there'd be 50 other Canadian tattooers there that would know that I didn't know what I'm doing. So my vulnerability started to get the best of me. By the time I got home, I had already resolved that I wasn't going to go to the convention and tattoo, and I was just going to be a spectator, because that's something he had mentioned to me on the phone when I first called. So about 2 weeks before the show, Paul Vickery calls me up and says, Ned, where's your registration? And I said, Oh, yeah. By the way, I think I'm just going to come and watch. He's like, no. He goes, send me your registration. He says, you're tattooing at this. And I'm like, okay. Yeah, sure. No problem. I'll send it right out. Get off the phone. Click. Screw that. I'm not doing that. No way. So about a week before the convention was about to take place, Paul Vickery calls me back up, and he says, Ned, where is your registration form? And I said, oh gosh, I don't know. Like, I think you were probably right. I'm not maybe ready for this, and I should just come and spectate this year. And he's like, no, you are coming and tattooing at this show. So then what happens next is he says, look, he says, you're coming. That's the end of the story. I'm going to give you the booth for half the price, and you can pay me at the end of the weekend if you make money. So now at that point, there's no way I could turn this down and say, no, I'm not going to do it. If I did, I'd be disrespecting him, because he's obviously providing a really good opportunity for me. So I go and I tattoo at this convention, and it turned out to be one of the best experiences of my life. And it was actually a dream come true.
Okay.
Halfway through the convention, I was sitting tattooing, and I was beside the stage, and Mike Austin was over to the other side of me. And I looked over at Mike and I said, music's loud, eh? And he says, yeah, man, no doubt. And chills ran through my spine. I actually dreamed that scenario, that exact scenario. I had a dream about it. I dreamed that I was tattooing at a convention, and a very talented artist was beside me. And I looked over at him and said, music's loud. And he said, no doubt. And in that moment, my whole body was just, chills ran through my spine. And the funny thing about it too, is that I was the least talented artist and the least trained, and the owner of the show put me beside the best artists of the show.
Oh, really?
What I found out later on was a lot of artists were not happy I was there. They thought I had no business on that convention floor, because they knew I was a scratcher. But for whatever reason, and I think Paul was following his heart in that moment when he said, you're coming, this convention's for you. Mm-hmm. I think there was a knowingness inside of him, because it seemed more than just a decision that he made. He seemed so firm in that decision that that's what I was supposed to do, and that's what he was supposed to do. So years later, I found out, you know, the guy that eventually helped me and trained me as an artist, he stood up to his peers at that convention. He told me the story about at that show, artists were complaining to him, saying, you know, that's bullshit, that kid's over there tattooing, he's got no business. And the guy that helped me out the most in tattooing, his name's Mac Bregg. He tattooed at Express U Tattoo in Kingston.
Okay.
And Mac stood up to those guys and he said, that kid over there has more heart than all you guys put together. He saw something in me. He saw that I had a true tattooer's heart, and that tattooing ran deeper than just a desire in me. Huh. But the thing about the whole scenario is that, you know, I was so incredibly vulnerable. By the time I realized the decision that I had made, to get in front of 50 other Canadian tattooists And I knew that they would know. I didn't know what I was doing. It made me very vulnerable. But in that convention, I stretched myself and I grew considerably. And what I realized is that I was putting labels on myself. I was labeling myself as a newbie. I'm not good enough. They're going to know that I suck. You know, there was voices in my heads and I was putting labels on me.
And you knew that consciously?
Not at the time. No. Mm-hmm. It's only in hindsight when I look back at the whole scenario that I realized that, wow, I walked through some big vulnerabilities. In the moment, it was just, I was scared as hell. Mm-hmm. Like I was nervous. I was afraid and I didn't want to look stupid in front of everybody, mm-hmm. but I was willing to forego the voices in my head and forego any labels I had created towards and put onto myself.
Yeah. Just out of curiosity, do you still talk to Paul?
I did. I interviewed him for the book.
Oh, did
the
you?
Tattoo history book. Yeah.
Did that situation come up in your interview?
We talked about it. And when I write my book on the history of Canadian tattooing, I'm sure the story will end up somewhere, maybe in my own profile.
So in that situation where you feel vulnerable, you could even have overwhelming sensation of vulnerability, insecurity. Just out of curiosity, too, did any of those feelings produce anger? Because you said earlier that anger was your easiest feeling. Did you get that way with it, or were you just timid?
No, it was only me involved, and I would get angry at myself often, but in that scenario, I felt very insecure, and I was just, it was me alone with my insecurities and that.
Gotcha. So how did you manage to stay strong in that situation?
I made a decision that, well, I think it was when Paul, his will to get me there, and he phrased it in such a way that I just realized I couldn't back out. Mm-hmm. When I knew I couldn't back out, I actually closed the back door, and I just decided that I'm going to do this. And I did. I walked in there and I made a few things happen that were quite amazing. Like I didn't, at the time I was using like a pressure cooker and then boiling my instruments for like an hour and a half at a time, right, to make sure that it was getting sterilized. And so I went out and I bought, and this is like the first year of tattooing, and I probably only did like half a dozen, like two dozen tattoos in my first year on family and friends. But so I went out and bought an autoclave for the convention, because I didn't know that conventions had autoclaves there. That's how green I was. So I come rolling into the convention with my own autoclave. I think of people, that was like the number one thing, like, this kid doesn't know what he's doing. Why did he bring his autoclave? But it was a pretty funny scenario. When I got there and realized that nobody had their sterilizers, I'm like, okay.
Yeah. I'll just put that right back where I got it from.
Oh, no, I rocked it all weekend.
Yeah, no doubt.
Yeah. Yeah, I just went with it.
Yeah. So what were your takeaways from that weekend? So, you know, feeling really uncomfortable and vulnerable, how'd you feel on the other side?
I gained a strength. I realized that I'm stronger than I think, and the best way to get over something is get right on it. Mm. You know, and it was either going to defeat me or I was going to defeat it. But when I look at it now, is all I had to really do is just stay present, go from one moment to the next. What do I need to do? I need to pack the car, put all my gear in it. What do I need to do now? Drive there. What do I need to unpack your stuff? Put it in the hall. Like, it's just one moment after in front of the next, mm-hmm. and not allow my mind to overtake the scenario, to overthink it, and to start going into scenarios where I'm rehearsing what I think's going to happen. And right. I think that's a big part in choosing to be strong in life is not rehearsing all these predetermined outcomes. Mm-hmm. With each rehearsal, you know, we can sometimes feel a little bit more defeated because we think of more ways that we can't than ways that we can.
My ego is the part of me that complains and resists change. It is not the real me. The made-up version of myself finds problems with life, whereas the true self surrenders to what is.
So I want to change gears a little bit. I want to talk to you about the difference between the will of your heart and the will of the mind.
So the heart is a doorway into the soul. Your soul, it holds your destiny. Your destiny is imprinted in your soul. And your heart knows everything. It knows everything that is destined to be yours. And it's not that the heart has a will, but it rather that it holds a destiny. So, and I talk about the will of the heart and the will of the mind in the book, but to push that a little bit further, there's really no will of the soul. There's only a knowingness there. But if I take that a little bit further, where did that destiny in my soul come from? Where do you think the destiny in your soul comes from?
I'm not sure.
If that destiny, would you agree that we come into the world with a destiny?
Potentially, I suppose. I'm not really certain on that.
And neither am I. So this is a conclusion that I've come to in my life, okay? So I've come to the conclusion that the destiny in my soul was given to me by the Creator. It was given to me before I came here. And so that, in comparison to the will of my mind, is minuscule.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the will of the mind? The will of the mind is nothing more than a desire. And as that desire is filled, as we mentioned in the last series, the last podcast, that another one arises. Mm-hmm. And the will of your mind is a fruitless pursuit that will keep you chasing your tail forever. And for the rest of your life, your life could be just about a fruitless pursuit of your desires. Whereas the will of your soul, the knowingness of your soul in fulfilling your destiny is a much bigger thing. It's a completely different arena.
And I wonder how we identify that. Like we talked about surrendering the will of your mind in order to discover the will of your soul, right?
That's right.
Is that just the first step in order to get there? Is that the first step?
Yeah, it is. It really is. It's a practice that you put in place. You surrender your desires. Learn how to surrender the mind. Learn how to say no to your thoughts. Because the mind is like my teacher used to say, the mind is a jealous lover. The more attention you give it, the more it wants. And it really is. When you look at the quality and the condition of the desireful thoughts that are pouring into us from one moment to the next, it has an endless appetite to devour all of our attention and our energy.
Yeah, because we have talked about this a little bit. So surrendering the will of your mind allows you to start focusing on the will of your heart so that you can then begin to make better decisions, more purposeful decisions. And something I'm curious about with that is the time it takes for your heart to say something to you that you know is a purposeful decision so that you don't just go back to what your mind happens to come up with. Can it take a while to figure out what it is that you ought to be doing, like your purpose?
That's a really great question. And I think we're going to dive more deeply into that in session 8. But a short answer to that is that the fulfillment of our purpose happens from one moment to the next. It's not something that you know, if we ask a question of the to the heart's not going to give us words and say, here's the answer to your question. Mm-hmm. There's just going to be a knowingness, but that knowingness may not come over you for a while. I never know if, when I ask my heart something, if the answer will be immediate or if it's in 5 years.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because it's that uncertainty that creates sort of a fear, perhaps, that, that it isn't going to happen. And then you resort back to what you know, same old, what you used to do. I could see that being a complication in the matter for people, that if, like, they might be trying to wrap their heads around, like, how do you know when your heart's telling you something?
It's the most purposeful and needed things will automatically come forth in the moment you're in.
Mm-hmm.
There, it can, and I understand why you're asking, because when the mind, your mind has been your guide all your life, and that's your only tour guide that you've ever had, we don't know how valid or how to get into the heart. And so, but the heart is the ultimate tour guide of your life. It can be trusted. Once you learn how to go into the rest in your heart, and a bigger portion of it is learning how to stop listening and responding to your thoughts, creating that open space for the dialogue or the knowingness in you to arise. But because, you know, one of the quotes in my book, something that popped out while I was writing, is that my heart has never let me down. And there was a quote kind of all around that. I can't remember exactly what the quote is at the moment. But it the heart, when I trusted in my heart, it's been the best tour guide that I've ever wanted or needed. And it becomes a better source to lean into, because the heart knows everything.
Mm-hmm. See, I've had some situations. I've had enough situations in my life already that I can get on board with what the heart knows is what should be followed. But this is what's kind of interesting about that. I would make these decisions without really thinking about it at all. I'm going to do that. And it's almost strange to me as to why I would decide that that's the thing I'm going to do. I don't even really know that much. I'm just doing it now, and that's what we're doing. It's not until you're in it for a while, you're like, wow, I've done all of that. Where did all that come from? But the interesting thing is with those things, like this podcast would be one of them, I guess, it's not until way later my mind's actually catching up to what my heart knew like a year ago.
Mm-hmm.
You know, where like now the mind's convinced, okay, yeah, that was a good call. Like that all, it's all making sense. But there was like this gut feeling. A lot of people talk about their gut feeling. You know, if it's sitting well in your gut, you know, okay, yeah, I feel comfortable with that. Mm-hmm. And that's the heart, right?
Well, the gut feeling, yeah, it can be intuition, the heart, similar. It's all the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So another thing I want to talk to you about, and this was brought up in the book, was, and we talk about this actually a lot in the Drum Gap podcast, is something I'm a big advocate of, is to encourage people to use their voice more to communicate rather than voiceless communication, such as texting, emails, so on and so forth. I'd like to hear your take on social skills being deprived in our society right now.
Yes, this is a topic I briefly bring up in the book, and I bring it up because in the chapter of strength, because it is a strength to be able to have face-to-face conversations. It develops communication and social skills that we don't gain by sitting back and doing just communicating through texting and through online. The art of extemporaneous speaking, or better known as impromptu speaking, is a valuable skill. And it's a tool that I use all the time in my life. I've learned how to have spontaneous conversations. Mm-hmm. If you say good morning to me, I'm not going to be stuck for an answer. You know, and there's a thing about this face-to-face interactions is that there's an energetic connection that is more easily bridged when we're connecting face-to-face. We're sort of in each other's field of feeling. Mm-hmm. You know, and it's not that we can't connect to each other from distance, but when we're face-to-face, you know, maybe you're picking up more of my body language. You're picking up more of the vibe in the room. Mm-hmm. And there tends to be a deeper communication that springs forth in a face-to-face conversation. Mm-hmm. When we lean only on stop-start communications where you text me something and then I may think about it for 2 hours, there's something that's lost in that transaction. And what's lost is the ability to think on your toes, to create quick synapses in the mind. So then this is where the mind becomes a benefit and a tool for us. You know, I talk greatly about setting the mind down, set the mind down. I'm always telling people, set your mind down, stop thinking. Now, this is where the mind is useful. The mind is a tool that we use. Sometimes I'll frame it to around, you know, if you think about a carpenter, mm-hmm. a carpenter has all kinds of tools, but if the carpenter carried all of his or her tools while trying to do a job, how effective would that carpenter be?
Not very.
Can you imagine a roofer on a roof with a table saw strapped to his back? So that's like Seamus almost choked on his coffee, just for the listeners.
That was a close call.
So that's what we need to do with the mind. We need to be able to think of it as a tool that we pick up and we set down. You know, and we don't need to carry the mind around when it's not necessary, but in a face-to-face interaction, we want to be able to use our mind. We want to be able to just quickly respond to what's going around us.
So do you think, though, that our society is being deprived socially? Like, are you seeing that? Do you witness that?
I do. I see it in some people. I see some people who, you know, their social skills are being a little bit retarded because they're not communicating, you know, as effectively as maybe I would like to communicate with somebody. In one word answers. How are you today? Good.
I've noticed with the older generation, they can pick up a conversation much better. It's That's something right. I've noticed. They're almost easier to approach in some way as well, because they don't leave you hanging conversationally. And I don't know, some of the conversations I have with people that spend more time on their phones or social media, etc., they are a little harder to tap into. And there's also, you sense a different side of them as well. Like, people have become very outspoken and candid on social media because it's less confrontation. You're not actually arguing or debating with someone in real life. Makes it a lot easier for you to also calculate your message as well. When we're talking about thinking on your toes, it's hard for things to come to mind right away when you're flustered. If you're in the middle of an argument, which you see a lot of online. Mm-hmm. And so I just wanted to get your take on that, because it's something that I have noticed, and it's something that I've encouraged the listeners of the Drum Gab podcast to be more aware of that and try to practice more with communicating with their voice or with a video or just something more than just texting. Because that, I find that if you're not practiced socially, you can lose touch with that. Even though we socialize from when we're little, if you're not constantly sharpening that blade, it tends to get pretty dull pretty quickly. It actually doesn't take long. I would imagine if you could be a social butterfly out at different events all the time, talking with people all the time. If you were to seclude yourself for a month or two and come out, you would be quite a bit further behind than had you have kept up with that. So that's interesting. I wanted to get your take on that. And we're about to discuss fears. And part and parcel to that, I wanted to know if, you know, because we are becoming a little more inward and distant from socializing or being honest. And when I say socializing, I'm not saying like people aren't going out and seeing one another. What I'm saying is that people's true thoughts, like the things they really want to say, they save it for what's the easiest form to get that out. You know, so like I was talking about with confrontation and things like that, it's easy to have a confrontation on a text than it is to have it in real life. It's more uncomfortable to have that in real life for like what you said, the vibe in the room. You actually have to look at them. Like all of these things add to the equation of being uncomfortable and vulnerable.
Well, there's a component to that. If we're not emotionally adept, if we don't have a good control over our emotions, there's a chance that face-to-face interactions can be overwhelming. And this is a topic that I hear with different people, that they feel overwhelmed while having face-to-face interactions. Mm-hmm. So the answer and solution to that is not to hide away and avoid that scenario. It's to take it on, go full on with that. If your emotions are out of check or out of balance, maybe it's time for you to look at your understanding your emotions. What are emotions? What are they used for? How do we start to become more emotionally intelligent? You know, Daniel Goleman wrote an amazing book on emotional intelligence, and that's something we'll dig in later and talk a little bit more about that. Mm-hmm. Is emotional intelligence. But again, if holding back and submitting to your fears and to your vulnerabilities is how you're going to play out the duration of your life, you're probably going to lead a pretty mundane life that's limited in purpose.
Yeah, because it could be said, this is my personal experience, and I wonder how many of the listeners share this same experience, but you notice that the things that take sometimes the most convincing to get up and go and go do that thing tend to be quite rewarding. I mean, provided that it's not something of total disinterest, but it's something that challenges you, is what I mean. Like, you may have an interest in it, like your tattooing thing. It's a great example, right? I mean, that scared you and you weren't sure if you belonged there. And I mean, even after the fact, people did voice that. Did they say that directly to you, by the way?
No.
You heard that through the grapevine?
No, I found out later that's what was being said.
Yeah. But those opportunities where you go out and you do something that you weren't sure about and made you feel uncomfortable, sometimes when it's all said and done, it's nowhere near as bad as you had imagined it to be, because we can put these things on quite great pedestals.
And that's a point too. Like once you do, the point I'd like to make is if once you overcome one fear, you now have a recipe to overcome any fear. You just have to do it once and realize that, hey, I can overcome my fears here. I can walk through my vulnerabilities. And, you know, our fears, they have a way of deepening when we submit to them. So they just get bigger and bigger and bigger. And the problem with the mind is that it'll accept anything as a truth. If you tell yourself something long enough, the classic length of time is 21 days, form a new habit. But to change a belief, you know, it may take a little bit longer. But if you keep telling yourself something, it becomes your truth. It doesn't make it true, but it becomes your truth. And fears are something that can just overwhelm you in life. And we'll even put, like I just mentioned a few minutes ago about labels, we'll put labels on ourselves and then hold ourselves to that labels. You know, most of the labels that we put onto ourselves are irrational decisions that we've made about ourselves.
Mm-hmm.
You know, think about that for a minute. Think about a label that you put on yourself in the past. I'm not good at this, or I'm not good at interacting socially. So now you've put a label on yourself, and that's just an irrational decision that you've made up in your mind. And the truth and the reality of that is that your soul is not insignificant. Your soul is able to, it's unharmed. It's not afraid. It's not vulnerable. It's completely unscathed in situations where we don't feel okay or safe, or in situations we're afraid of. Mm-hmm. But that vulnerability squishes out any, or the label that we put on ourselves squishes out any chance of moving forward, as long as we're holding that mental position. Because a label is nothing more than a mental position. No, I get it. There's labels that get placed on us that are valid. You know, like if you have an attention deficit disorder, then, you know, that may be a valid label for you. But I don't think that we should ever live up to those labels. Even if we are, say I have OCD or seasonal affective disorder, SAD, doesn't mean that I need to live up to that label and hold myself to that, because maybe that's a standard that I'm going to rise above from. And as soon as we hold ourselves to any label, all we're doing is we're holding ourselves to the past. And like I say, it may be a standard that's not relevant for this moment today. Maybe we have ADD, but maybe in spite of that, we still carry on and become all the things that we need to in this life. We do and become everything that's most purposeful in our life, and we still happen to have ADD.
Yeah, right.
I interview people for my site, You Matter, all the time that have different obstacles in their life, and in spite of that, they're still succeeding.
Mm-hmm. Well, you actually, there was a brief story in the book talking about someone who has anxiety.
Mm-hmm.
And can you share that with us?
It was another one of my Ashaya monk friends. And when he was younger, he was told that he has anxiety. And so he went to his 6-month meditation retreat, and he didn't bring enough medication to get himself through the entire retreat. So he figured, you know, 2-3 months in, he's going to be good. He's not going to be having any more anxiety attacks.
Mm-hmm.
So he runs out of medication and he's doing okay. And then one day he suddenly starts having a panic attack, and he went to the teacher, Maharishi, and he said, you know, I need to go to town. And Maharishi says, well, that's not part of the program. What's going on? And he said, well, can't you see I'm having an anxiety attack? And he says, okay, well, I'm going to need you to do something for me. And my Ashaya friend's like, are you kidding me? I'm having an anxiety attack. Can't you tell? Like, look, I'm freaking out here. I can't do anything for you.
Mm-hmm.
And Maharishi says, no, that's fine. I'll take you to town. You just do one thing for me. He goes, all right, what? So Maharishi says, I want you to take the label off of what you're experiencing. And so he's like, what do you mean? I'm having an anxiety attack. He says, I know. That's what you're saying. I want you to take the label off of that. So he did. He removed the label off of what he was experiencing. And so instead of saying that he was experiencing anxiety, he just let go of the notion that there's anxiety in his body and just watched the feeling. And within a few minutes of just watching the sensation that was happening in his body, tears started streaming down his face. Maharishi says, well, what's going on now? He said, I feel blissed out. There was something deeper happening. He's like, I'm blissed out. I have extreme joy right now. And he says, well, what's your Ashaya name? And he said, Paramananda. And he says, what does Paramananda mean? He said, highest bliss. So the Maharishi named him after an experience that he had been having all of his life. But because he was told there were anxiety attacks, he just went on and kept taking medication in accordance to having anxiety. But he really wasn't having anxiety. You know, he is having moments of bliss. And mm-hmm. and to this day, far as I know, he doesn't take medication. And this isn't me saying that if you have anxiety attacks, drop your medication. You know, you don't want to just drop things suddenly. This would be something that you'd want to work out with your doctor. But it is important to look at the labels that you place upon yourself, because they can be very crippling if you hold yourself to that standard. And if you hold yourself to that standard all your life and never go beyond it, you're certainly not living your potential.
Absolutely. That, and we won't get into this because I think it's out of my wheelhouse. But in any case, I'm sure there's probably people who just heard that might be thinking misdiagnoses and people being medicated when they don't really need to be. That's something that comes to mind, because that seems like kind of the norm anymore. It's, you know, oh, you're experiencing these side effects, or this is what you're going through. Well, that's this, and here's the medication for that. In that situation, in that isolated situation, he no longer needed his medication. That's a thought. I think that's kind of an interesting thought, too, is how many people might be being medicated when they don't really need to be. And mm-hmm. I think of the cost involved with people that have no health care.
Or taking something beyond its expiry point. Because I've been through a lot of things in my life, and you could probably slap a number of labels on me. You know, do I need to medicate myself? No, I need to get a better check on reality, get my thoughts in check, mm-hmm. and learn how to create emotional intelligence in myself, learn how to back up from my emotions. So if your emotions are overwhelming, and like we were just talking about social interactions, if they're overwhelming in a social interaction, mm-hmm. then that's something that I need to practice. I need to bring myself into social settings and practice. I used to do that with my little brothers. I was a big brother through the Big Brothers Agency.
Mm-hmm.
And I had one little brother who was very shy to talk. And so we made a deal, and it was, of course, on his terms, and he agreed with this, that the first half of our visit, that we would go to a store every time, and he had to talk to the clerk. He had to ask one question and ask for help with something.
Mm-hmm.
So every time we got together, we'd go to, usually it was Future Shop, or, and he would ask one of the attendants there a question. And then after that, we would go to a restaurant, and I would tell him what I wanted, and he had to order to the waitress.
Oh, okay.
So it gave him just a tiny little bit of something to do, to practice with that, instead of enabling him in his inability to converse with strangers. I gave him an opportunity to grow beyond that. I gave him an opportunity to push beyond his vulnerabilities. I created an opportunity for him so that he no longer had to fear that, because he was just diving in and doing little bits. He was doing what he could from the place he's in. And that's all we ever need to do.
Those small steps can make, and that's necessary, I think, especially if there is a crippling amount of self-doubt and worry about making, like, I can relate to that. Like somebody ordering your food, if they're not comfortable with that kind of responsibility, I could see how that could be a massive thing. And when we talk about fears again, something really interesting in the book that I'm recalling is how my fears may seem like absolutely nothing to you. Like that we can actually get through our fears pretty quickly. Sometimes they seem like these massive inflated things that our mind has managed to fabricate. But in reality, it might not take very much to move through your fear.
That's right.
Because it's not very big in actual fact.
Well, what I'm afraid of may seem, like you say, insignificant to you, mm-hmm. but what you're afraid of may be insignificant to me. So what does that tell you? The reality of a fear is that it may be not true at all. It may not be anything to be afraid of. And by going into that and a willingness to go into to tackle our fears, you know, may be the solution to overcoming them.
Yeah, because sometimes by avoiding our fears too, it just creates much bigger problems as well. Like if somebody, for example, is afraid about their finances and getting a call from a collector or something like that. This is a very real thing where people get themselves in uncontrollable debt. And when the phone rings, what if it's a collector? And then you avoid the call because mm-hmm. you're afraid to answer the phone. Well, all you're doing now is postponing what should be dealt with because you're afraid. And now your fear is going to just grow even larger because you're not handling your business. And so there could be situations where by avoiding your fears, you're actually creating a very real problem.
That's right.
That becomes a bigger fear in your mind as well, because you're aware of the severity of the issue and that you're avoiding it. Mm-hmm. Okay. So also in the book, you state that the mind or the ego hates change and it much prefers a routine. So what kinds of routines are healthy? And what routines are we trying to expel when we are talking about making ourselves uncomfortable with change?
Okay, so the question of what routines are healthy. Now, I personally don't think that, you know, when we're excessive in our routines, that's when it becomes unhealthy. And what is healthy is not being addicted to your routines. So if you can, I would invite people to avoid routines, you know, to allow life to be spontaneous and to allow the spontaneity to unfold in your life. You know, if we're bound to complete what we did yesterday and the day before, we're not allowing the aliveness of this moment to unfold as naturally. And we're blocking all that's coming to us right now by needing to control our life through routine, you know. So, but then on the other side of the coin, if you're in a dark place or you're stressed out, routines can be something you lean into to feel familiarity, to make you feel a little more comfortable, you know. So there is a time when that a routine may help ground and stabilize you if you're having a difficult time, you know, or the routine, say this is where if you have a favorite friend that you go and visit or your family member, if you're feeling unstable, then the routineness of seeing that friend may be enough to help jar you out of the experience you're having. One of my favorite quotes that I've written is that in between all our greatest moments, the miracles are still happening. So if we're stuck in routines, we're missing what's unfolding in our life. We're missing the miracles that are taking place in between our greatest moments of life.
Yeah, and so with setting up expectations in your mind, and we're talking about the routines, and that's... like, I want to know, like, how micromanaging your life is a detriment, and why do we need to let go of controlling every outcome and not being flexible within our own designs?
Mm-hmm.
Is micromanaging and tasking and that sort of thing is another thing that is becoming a popular thing, because people are claiming that our lives are really, really busy and we need order and structure in order to be proficient and efficient in our day-to-day life. I'm not even on the fence with that. I personally like to, like, I already know what responsibilities I have and that things need to be completed, mm-hmm. but I like to sort of attend to things as it comes to me. Like, You know, even if it's just an observation, it's like, well, that needs to be dealt with now.
That's right.
Because things will come up. Like, life is a little too random, I feel, to micromanage your entire day. Well, what do you think about that?
Oh, I think you're absolutely right. And we do not need to control and micromanage our life. Being flexible is such an important part of living. Everything is in the state of change. And, you know, as soon as something manifests into this world, you know, the world changes as a result of it. But that thing that comes into the world, all of our creations change until they eventually go away or they return back to dust. So change is a natural part of life. And not being flexible with change and needing to micromanage things, you know, we're trying to squish this moment to fit the narrowness of our mind. Okay. So when we try to make life conform to our ideas, what tends to happen is we get frustrated because life cannot be reduced to such a small potential. And the mind is just a sliver of potential. And whereas life itself is a 40-lane highway of potential streaming towards us at any one moment. And the mind is like an overgrown footpath in comparison. Mm-hmm. So when we try to squeeze a 40-lane highway into an overgrown footpath, we're drastically reducing the potential of what could and what should be and what ought to be. You know, and this moment can't be squeezed into that. So what is actually happening is what's meant to happen. You know, and it's only your mind that's in opposition of it. But I know there's people that can throw up a flag and say, well, what about if somebody attacks another person? Common sense is still necessary. You know, it doesn't mean that when I say things are happening and they should be happening, you know, it doesn't mean that if we see somebody getting attacked, that we don't react to injustice. You know, that we be alive and fresh with this moment and say, I'm going to go over there and help that person.
Right.
You know, we follow our instincts in those moments. But there also is maybe a whole bunch of reason why that person was attacked that we don't know of. You know, maybe the person getting attacked was abusing that other person's child. We don't know that. So, like, we work, and I've worked out a few ideas on this over the last number of years that makes me kind of, and these are the ideas, is that I don't know the reason why things are the way they are. And when I try to squeeze this moment to be everything I want it to be, I'm really missing out on the potential possibilities of greatness coming into my life. It really does diminish that.
I also think too, like if I was to visualize someone's day, that their day begins with tasking out every little thing, every chore, every duty and responsibility that they need to see through throughout the course of the day. That means that now all of a sudden you have blinders on and you're just looking to the next thing that you've predetermined, that your mind has come up with, okay, after I eat lunch, I need to do this. After I do that, I need to go do this thing. And that's sort of like a tunnel vision to your next objective. It's kind of like even going right back to the very beginning when we're talking about check marks. Okay, I got that mm-hmm. thing done, got that thing done. These things are supposed to make us feel like our day was filled with accomplishments, that we managed to get through that entire list of things that we set out for ourselves to do and complete from the start of our day. Mm-hmm. But now all of a sudden the randomness of life is not part of that equation. Like that's not figured into this micromanaged list of things, this to-do list, so to speak. Mm-hmm. Like obviously, like there's things like, let's just assume, okay, the date is July 8th. And on July 8th, that's when my credit card statement is due and I have to make that payment. Obviously, when you wake up, you know that you got to go and you have to pay that. So there might be like little things that you need to task out just so that you don't miss it and forget it, put them in your phone, do whatever you need to do. But there has to be people who exist who literally every minute of each day has been predetermined and they're just following that course. Mm-hmm. And that seems extremely limiting.
Well, you're ruling out the possibility for you to actually follow your purpose. Because if you've predetermined how your day is going to unfold, you're actually not living a purposeful day. You know, your purpose may include you getting to certain things, but that's the thing about our purpose is that it may not unfold the way that your mind thinks it's going to. And so allowing flexibility to live within your plans is a healthy way to stay disengaged from the mind and more engaged with the heart.
Now, you've mentioned this as well, that you're talking about change is constant, more or less,
mm-hmm.
If I paraphrase. But why would you say that change is such an integral part of life?
Because of what I was just talking about, how everything comes into this world and it changes. Like, everything is in motion. Nothing stays the same. Even physical solid objects are changing. They're changing on it at such a slow rate that we don't see it, but they are. Every part of this room is in decomposition. It's decomposing around us right now. We think that we live in a solid and stable reality, but the only thing that's solid and stable is the fact that nothing is solid and stable.
Yeah.
Everything is in the process of change, and that's a good thing. Like, I think about my business, and you know, I started out in tattooing in my home, and now where am I? I'm back tattooing in my home. Mm-hmm. My business went through this massive change where, you know, at one point I needed to get out in the public, and because I needed clients, and then when I got out in public and I started getting more clients, now I needed more tattooers because I couldn't keep up to all the business.
Right.
So I trained, you know, 5 tattooers. And then after I trained 5 tattooers, there ensued another whole set of problems that I had to work out. And then eventually they went off and they all opened up their own studios and become very successful. And I'm really proud of all the artists that I've trained in their ability to move on and become very successful. So now I'm back home by myself, right back to the beginning.
Yeah.
So, but the what has been difficult for me is that when I needed to hang on, when change was taking place, when I couldn't let go of something. When it was being made, when it made me let go of it, you know, when employees first started leaving, like, it for me that was painful. Like, these are like my children.
Yeah.
I was somewhat of a dysfunctional parent at times, which may have caused the change. But you know, when I finally got to a place where I allowed that change to happen, there was no more suffering for me. It was like, okay, this actually, when I pull back and look at it, this actually needed to happen. This change was inevitable.
When I was weak, I pretended to be strong. When I was strong, I no longer pretended to be anything other than what I am.
So another thing I'm curious about is how people can begin healing from events or traumas that extend into our lives by disempowering us.
Well, that's a good question. And it's when we're not willing to change, it generally creates more and more trauma in our life. And it creates things that we need to heal from. That's not the only way that the reason why we need to heal either. So the question, how can people begin healing from events and traumas? Okay, so the first one for me, and I can only relate this to some of my biggest upsets in life, is that I had a turbulent relationship with a person in my life. And for years, I couldn't accept that some of the things that happened. I couldn't accept it. And so that in and of itself was creating a block for me to even start to heal. Okay. And then another factor in which was a huge factor, and it was actually a huge realization for me to get over the hurts that I was feeling and some of the traumas that happened to me, is that I wasn't willing to stop being angry. I resolved that I wanted, you know, peace in my life, and I wanted to live a harmonious life, and I didn't want to be angry anymore. But this is one area where I allowed myself to be angry and to send anger towards another person. And the last thing that kept me from healing was I wasn't willing to stay committed to letting go of the past. You know, when we decide that we want to heal and move on from a drama or a trauma in our life, we have to accept what happened. In our acceptance, that doesn't mean that the other person was right or that you're wrong. It just means I accept it. I'm drawing a line in the sand, and from today forward, I realize that happened, and I can accept that happened. Because a lot of drama in my mind was that, how could this person do that? I love them. Mm-hmm. I cared about them. Why would they do that? And then it would get even more stingy and painful when I said, why would they do it to me? Because I personalized it. So in our acceptance, we just say, okay, it happened. Next, let's move on.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, so acceptance. And then the next step is we stop sending anger. If we remember an event from the past that's painful or difficult, we no longer send anger towards that person or situation. And the last step is stay committed to letting it go. No matter how many times the past rears its ugly head, you just accept it. Don't be angry with it. And don't go into the feelings or the emotions of it, and let it go. Let it go with love.
That's really interesting, because some people might hear that by accepting as a defeatist mentality.
That's right.
That you feel defeated. It's like, well, they won this one. I didn't get what I wanted out of them. Because I think sometimes too, like when we feel hurt and things happen to us, we start to think, our mindset becomes focused on vengeance in a sense. Mm-hmm. But the vengeance of, you're going to give me what I deserve. You know, I'm only going to feel better once you admit you're wrong, and that you can say that wholeheartedly and that I believe it, and then I can move on. So many people get hung up on that because it may never happen. And like you said, if it's not going to happen, the only thing that is going to happen is you're not moving anywhere. Your mm-hmm. forward motion gets depleted, right?
That's right. And you're putting your well-being in the hands of another person.
Yes. And then, I mean, depending on your situation, you might have a family. All of that turmoil, that then becomes a toxin for everyone who really has no business getting tangled up in your dramas and traumas.
That's right.
We're talking about. That's really simple, though. So let's go over that once more. So you said accept, stop sending anger to it, and then commit to accepting it and moving on with love.
That's right. And I, in the book, I created what I call a three-step healing. And that's basically the premise of the three-step healing. The first one, bring acceptance into the event that took place. Acceptance doesn't mean that the other person had the right to mistreat you. It just means you're drawing a line in the sand, and now you're stepping over and moving away from this trauma. The next step, number two, stop sending anger or holding anger around the event that you want to heal. And the third step is a very important one. Close your eyes and picture yourself holding this event in love. So call love to come up and wrap itself around you. Imagine you're surrounded with love and you can feel it absorbing into your body as you do this visualization. So you can visualize the event coming up that you feel you're stuck in and just imagine that you're surrounded with love and send love to yourself.
I hope I'm not getting too ahead of myself here, but there was a diagram that talked about whenever a trauma happens to a small piece of you.
Depending. Oh, yeah. Yep.
That's this, right?
Yep, that's right. Well, that's how we heal. We start to heal our traumas. And if we don't heal our traumas, then there's a good chance that we sort of leave part of us behind in these traumatic events. Mm-hmm. And eventually there's very little of you moving forward.
That to me makes a whole lot of sense because I felt that. Mm-hmm. You know, that's happened to me.
Yeah. Yeah. There is an importance of healing your wounds. If we don't heal the traumas in us, then there's a good chance that our vulnerabilities and our fears will continue to overpower us in our lives. So yes, looking back, there is it's a valid thing to do. How we know whether we need to look back and heal these traumatic events in our life is by, remember the first session we talked about taking inventory of your thoughts. Mm-hmm. What thoughts are coming to you? How often does past unrelated conflicts infect the moment you're in? How many times in a day, a week, a month are you affected by your past? And if your answer is any more than one or two times a day or a week, you know, then maybe it's something to look at. Mm-hmm. If it's creating drama, your trauma is creating drama in your life, that's when we need to employ this healing technique, going in and starting to change our relationship with that. And that's essentially what we're doing. We're pulling ourselves out of the past. We're healing our relationship with that story that's in our mind. Mm-hmm. You know, nobody wants to hear your story over and over and over again. We're generally, most people are too busy in their own stories to even absorb yours. But, you know, our stories can get old and hopefully they get old to us before they get old to the world at large. Like when we're reliving these traumas and it's creating drama in our life, mm-hmm. then I don't see that as a fruitful nor purposeful life to live.
I was seeing a thing, a meme the other day. Don't quit your daydream. I don't know. Have you ever seen that before?
No.
Anyways, I want to talk about Walt Disney. You bring up Walt Disney in the book. And the reason why I brought that up is just because that's something that's floating around on the internet. And it's kind of an interesting thing. Now, it doesn't, by saying don't quit your daydream kind of means don't quit thinking about what you want. But if we think about dreams and the things that we really, truly want to accomplish, Walt Disney said, if you can dream it, you can do it. So by making dreams become reality in your book, you boil it down into four C's, and they are curiosity, confidence, courage, and consistency. So this seems like a situation that's easier said than done. Which of those four C's do you think is the most difficult to maintain?
I think that'd be different for everyone. You know, some people would be naturally curious and so that would be easy, where other people's may not care and they maybe could employ a little bit more curiosity toward life. Mm-hmm. So I think what's going to be most difficult for me may be easy for you. And I think what the bigger thing at hand is Disney actually said this. He said that that the four C's are necessary in life. This is actually one of his quotes directly. Mm-hmm. Curiosity, confidence, courage, and consistency. So what he's doing in that quote, he's actually giving you a formula from which he creates his life. He learns how to be creative. He learns how to be consistent. And he has the courage to really go for the things that he wants to do. And he consistently shows up and does that. And if you look at all the creations that that man created, you would have to say that he was curious, confident, courageous, and consistent. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
It's quite a recipe for a full and rich life.
Let me ask you then, of those four C's, which one are you most naturally drawn to? Like, what's the easiest for you to pick up and start moving with?
I'm curious with courage. I'm not as confident, and sometimes I have to work at consistency, but I'm curious, and I have a lot of courage. That's one thing about me is that my dad taught me that at a very young age, that to go for the things you want in your life. It reminds me of this story about this little Inuit boy. And he goes running, one day he goes running out of the house and he's not wearing his jacket. And his mom, you know, she never said a word, but she had company. And the company said, hey, your son's running, he just went outside without a jacket on. And she says, shh, he doesn't know that it's cold outside. So he was given the opportunity to create his own lessons in life. And, you know, the mother wasn't fearful of her child. She had enough courage in her to let her son have her own lessons. And that's something my dad did for me. He wasn't fearful in his life. So he had the courage to let me live my own lessons.
Mm-hmm.
And it's been a real asset for my life.
Yeah, because courage and confidence seem like a sort of a close conversation, but I would have to say that courage is taking the first step and confidence is how you feel once you've stepped in. So would you say, like, once you begin doing something and, like, you are courageous, that the confidence is the difficult thing to sort of get down with? Like, that part is a little more challenging then?
Well, the courage is what initially gets you to do something, and mm-hmm. then confidence is employed in the act of doing. You have to be, it's when I trained my artists to become tattooers, the first time they tattoo an actual person, you know, it's a lot different than tattooing practice skin or tattooing, you know, grapefruits or whatever. So they're, and I would groom them throughout the training process, and I would tell them, you're a professional. You know more than the client does, and you don't ever present yourself in a light that the client knows more than you. They right. may know more about you in many topics, but in this application, you have to have the confidence. And with confidence, you'll win the client's respect. And I watched many artists that came through my business. The ones that had, they were confident, the clients never second guess them when it come to designs and applying the tattoos. But if they weren't confident and they didn't have the confidence to really do what they're doing, the client would start second guessing them.
Yeah, right.
Right away. The client would say, I don't like that. I want you to change this over there. So the client would feel that they needed to take over the session.
Mm-hmm.
But with a certain amount of confidence, the client can arrest their need to control because they know that they're in good hands.
So the last point that I want to touch on before we conclude this session here is you say that the real secret to being strong is simply being who and what you are. And why do you think this is an important part of becoming strong?
Well, I think the real secret of being strong is being who you are. It just, the answer is in the question. That is your real strength. Become you. There's only one you, and only you can do you. And when you try to do anything that's not you, you're not nearly as purposeful, nor will you be as strong as you will be by doing what you need to do in your life. by being who you need to be in your life. And then sometimes the strength and the courage, and it comes in the act of doing. And I've found that many times when I needed to be strong, it sort of happened in the moment. So just be willing to get up and move, and you'd be surprised how much moves in the act of you just standing up.